Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for joining us on the show this week. My guest is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. If you've got a question you'd like to ask him, call 496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Good afternoon. Good to see you as always.
Hey, Stan. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with a couple of listener questions that have come in. The first one says, what can be done about the trash being thrown out of cars? Is there an ordinance prohibiting this? And if there is, why is it not enforced?
Well, there certainly is there's actually a state law that deals with littering. And certainly, you know, I'm going to be pretty direct about this. I mean, it's kind of a sad state of affairs where that becomes a government issue. I mean, I think we were all raised where you're not supposed to throw trash out your window. And the fact that we would have to enforce that, I think, is you know, not a good thing. Our police officers do enforce that from time to time, not a lot. You have to see the person throw it out. You have to be there the exact minute that they're throwing that out the window, not be on your way to a call or doing something else and be able to turn around. And of course, I can tell you from being a policeman, when you stop somebody from doing that, the first words out of their mouth are, don't you have anything better to do than worry about litter, which is, you know, it is important. So we are going to roll out a couple new programs later in the month. We'll be doing some formal announcements of things that we're going to do that we think will help with that. Our officers know they can enforce that. But again, I think that's a societal problem. It's kind of like government having to force people to mow their yards. We really shouldn't have to be spending taxpayer dollars on forcing people or writing tickets to not throw stuff out their window. But we'll continue to work on it. And we ask that parents teach their children and children teach their parents. And we get back to that's just not being a good citizen, throwing things. And I'm not sure when all that changed, because we were raised not to do that. And, you know, help people remind each other that, you know, you're not supposed to be throwing your trash out the window as you're driving down the road.
I'm glad you mentioned lawn mowing, because, of course, we're getting to that time of the year again. I'm dreading already having to pull the lawnmower out of the garage for the first time this spring. What is the threshold there, I was wondering, for, let's say that a neighbor down the street lets their grass grow and grow and grow. At what point would my call as a citizen to the city result in the city doing something? What is the threshold at which the city goes, okay, this is really a problem?
Well, the ordinance is pretty specific about that. It's 11 inches. So once grass, you know, gets over 11 inches, you know, we can be notified, and we get notified. Unfortunately, we end up mowing hundreds of yards a year that people don't end up mowing even after we notify them. So if you called in, we would send a letter to the homeowner and or the occupant and say, hey, you're in violation. We give them 7 days to mow. If they don't mow in 7 days, we send them a second letter. And I know the grass is getting higher. I understand it. But we do try to then they get a $50 fine. And then if they still don't mow, we put it on our mowing list, and we actually go on the property and mow the yard, and then we put a lien against the property. And like I said, we mow hundreds, probably in a few hundred yards, and we mow some of them more than once. We actually do more mowing in the summer than we would prefer. We're not really in the lawn mowing business of people's private property.
Well, and heavens to Betsy, if your lawn gets to be 11 inches tall, I mean, it takes a long time, even when grass is growing quickly, for it to get to 11 inches.
Right. You're not going to be just gone on vacation. But if that does happen where people have taken extended vacation, again, if people would just notify us, right? If they would just communicate with us, and it's very easy for us to work things out, make arrangements like that. But yes, the ordinance is 11 inches. Once it gets over 11 inches, that's when we get involved.
Another listener question says, asks whether anything can be done about the generators that vendors use at Mosey Down Main Street. Of course, we're approaching that season as well. This person says, they're so loud you can't hear each other talk around some of the booths because the generators are so loud.
Well, I'd have to talk with the Friends of Downtown that, you know, administer and put on the Moseys down Main Street and see, you know, you really can't cover generators because they have to be able to breathe and stuff. So I just have to look into that. I don't have a good answer for your caller other than I can mention that. Obviously, we need to use generators for the musical acts and some other things like that that are taking place. And I've been to the Mosey's, and it can be maybe a little loud around the bands. I'm not sure that I've not ever been able to talk or anything, but
I get the sense that this person might be talking more about the mobile food stands and things like that, as you need to keep your equipment running to keep the food warm or something like that. Because you could have multiple of those along either side of the street.
Yeah, you could. That's true, and we do. I don't like making stuff up. I don't really have a good answer for that. We can look into it, but I'm not sure, other than people may be buying more very, very expensive generators that are quieter, but that, I mean, that could be cost prohibitive for folks. I'm not sure I have a good answer for that.
Okay. If you want to get your questions in to Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski today, send those via email to ask@wbaa.org. Call them in to 496-1999 or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. So yesterday, all three school corporations here in the county hosted rallies advocating for better teacher pay than what the governor and State House Republicans have proposed, which is about 2%. But a number of teachers around here told me yesterday they thought they weren't even going to get that, and some might even take a net loss based on the different financial calculi there. Is this an issue that you've been following or that people have been coming to, educators have been talking to you about?
Yeah, I mean, it's really is a community, a statewide and a community issue. It's one of those, you know, kitchen table issues I talked about that people really do care, and it's a big deal. I mean, you know, education is the foundation of our communities, and we talk about, as we have on this show and in news stories, workforce development. Well, getting that basic education and those opportunities is critical for our continuing workforce development in our community and training our young people to have the skills necessary to hire to be part of a variety of different types of jobs. Everything from a machinist to an engineer to a tool and die maker to a doctor. And so, you know, that education and that foundation of K through 12 education is just critically, critically important. And, you know, I saw some data where Indiana is basically dead last now in teachers' pay. When you look at the child abuse rates, the infant mortality rate, some of those things, you know, they do send up a red flag. And I think, again, childhood, pre-K education, a great educational foundation is one of the number one ways to move people out of generational poverty, to open new doors of opportunity for people. And then to not pay our teachers, I mean, to be, you know, dead last, and you look at what some of those pays are, I mean, I think, you know, we really do as a state need to make a commitment to those teachers. And, you know, we all know their job has become increasingly difficult. They're a teacher, they're a policeman, they can be, have to be a counselor, they help with food and coats and different things that kids don't have, and kids come into school with a lot of different issues that maybe are going on at home, and the days of just being able to walk in and just teach are pretty hard some places. And so we need to reward those teachers, and we know that it's difficult getting people to go into that profession now, and we are losing people because of the pay, because they have to be able to support their families. And when you look at the starting salaries in the mid to low 30s and different things, I mean, I don't know how anybody, even over time, I don't know how anybody could say a teacher is overpaid or somehow salaries are out of kilter for what they should be making. They're nowhere near for all that we ask them to do and the importance that they play in our communities and society. And I think we've got to find a way to turn that table.
I thought about the Ask the Mayor conversations I have with you and the other three mayors on a monthly basis when yesterday Teresa Meredith, the head of the Indiana State Teachers Association, got up at West Lafayette High School in the morning and was talking to the crowd, and she was perhaps a little more pointed than she might have been. She said, you know, if lawmakers had heard that this was not the most business-friendly state in the union, or we weren't business profitable, do you think they would stand by? And her contention is no, and her exact words were, they'd move heaven and earth to make sure it wasn't that way. perhaps that's a little tilted toward one side of the argument, but it does bring up an interesting point that I hear from you mayors all the time, which is I have heard that one of the things that investors, when they're thinking about locating in a community, first ask is, how are the schools? Would you say that's an accurate statement?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, you know, anymore, the first things you hear about are, how are your schools? What type of quality of life initiatives do you have going? Arts, culture, recreation, you know, things that they know they're going to need to attract and retain employees that want to live here. They want to be here and they want to be a part of the community. And so, you know, as we look at this marketing coalition that we have going now, I mean, we're really focusing on how do we market quality of life initiatives? How do we market our schools? Because that's absolutely right. And the reality is the best business climate in the world, lowest taxes. If you don't have the workforce, if you don't have the people with the skills to fill the jobs, if you don't have the people that have problem-solving skills, creativity, the ability to do that, at some point, that's not going to matter, because no matter what that climate is, if you don't have the workforce to fill it, if you don't see that pipeline coming that to have the employees to make your business profitable, turn out that product that you need, it's not going to matter. And so we really do need to work to find a balance between those two to ensure long term we have the capacity here in our community and our state to ensure that we stay successful and to lift, you know, move people forward, continuing education, retraining when necessary, but really getting that pre-K, and I stress pre-K through high school, solid rock education. And, you know, we're opening a school corporations are opening a vocational tech high school here in the community, which I think is incredibly important that we find that balance between kids that are going to get those four-year degrees and two-year degrees and then technical certifications to meet the demands on a lot of different levels. And we're going to have that kind of flexibility, but we're going to have to make that kind of investment in education.
One of the things the teachers were talking about yesterday is whether they need to take additional steps. And the teachers, to a person yesterday, said, we don't think we're at the state that West Lafayette would have to do what West Virginia did this spring and last spring, which is walk off the job to send the message that they need to be treated better. But obviously, in a community like this, where you've got three decent-sized school corporations, you've got Purdue University, this is a place where education is really, really important. And it seems to me that if we got to that point, this community, Greater Lafayette, would be potentially harmed, especially the kids, because if you have a walkout of that scale, holy cow, in this community, what that would mean.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you always want those types of situations to be last resort situations, because there are significant impact to a lot of people on a lot of different levels. But I certainly applaud the teachers for the direction that they're taking at this point. But I also support them that they need to stand up for themselves and they need to be heard. And I mean, when you go into our schools, you see fantastic things happening and people dedicating their lives to these kids and trying to help them have a better life. And they should be paid appropriately for that. I mean, none of them ever didn't take those jobs so they would become rich, but they need to be paid so at least they can afford to live and to support their own families. I mean, lots of them spend their own money helping getting their classrooms together. And I just don't know where the disconnect started, where all of a sudden we decided it was okay that teachers' salaries wouldn't keep up with other salaries. I mean, you know, there's many jobs throughout this community, many, many, many jobs in government and the private sector that pay significantly more than what teachers do. And then to not get all of a sudden where we don't reimburse them or there's no credit for getting additional education, like your master's degree and those things. I mean, that's just out of the model that most places do. The more education you get, the more you better yourself. You got a better chance for better pay and better opportunity. And I really do feel like we've went backwards in a lot of those areas.
Got a call in from a listener, James, who says that he heard Lafayette ranks among the top cities in the state. And I think he means top, meaning most, for hate crimes. He wants to know first if that's true. If not, where he might find correct statistics and how the city works to fight racism, supremacy, and things like that, big picture. And I'll try and provide a little bit of context. We did some reporting late last year that pointed out first that it's a little hard to track these statistics because the state has not had a hate crimes law. And so definitions therein can be kind of hard to come by in the first place. But there were some statistics that our reporter Charlotte Tuggle found that the city of Lafayette had 8 hate crimes in 2017. Police hadn't been able to solve any of those yet, and there had been a couple in 2018 so far. And so it seems like there is some of this. What is your current working on this, especially as the state has passed now at least a first version of a hate crimes bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, a lot of it, you're not required to report, right? So not every city even reports. So
sure.
It's really hard to say that if who had the most in the state of Indiana, because you're not even required to report those. We're very transparent about reporting those issues. And so I think are probably going a little bit overboard. After that report came out, I was kind of surprised myself, and I had the police department come over and I said, I don't even see some cities on here. You telling me they had zero? There's no way. And it's like, well, not everybody even has to report. They don't have the guidelines. But we do. We've been very transparent and we report. Actually, you know, after we went through it all, that 8, probably we had 3 or 4 that should have been reported, and the others probably we erred severely on the side of interpretation of the guidelines for what we reported. And so I don't feel that we have a significant amount, more than anybody else or any higher percentage based on our population in the community. Certainly, they are not tolerated. That's not something that we promote here. We include being inclusive, celebrating diversity. I think myself and Mayor Dennis and all the elected officials here have made that clear. And so that's something we certainly don't tolerate. You know, it's hard to catch. One of the crimes that was reported was somebody wrote on a sidewalk in front of a house that had a Confederate flag fronted, and they wrote, "Are you," and I'm not going to use the bad words in it, but they were upset about the Confederate flag that was flying in a window. We put that down as a hate crime. I'm not sure there's actually a victim there, and that's what we talked about. That is something that we should have actually, reported that. One of them had to do with a bumper sticker on a truck. I mean, is there actually, we don't appreciate what it said and people didn't, but is that actually a hate crime? And so,
well, what's your opinion of the hate crimes bill that's now been passed that doesn't have the full list of victim characteristics?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you covered it or not. I'm sorry, but some of the media did that. Myself, Mayor Dennis, and Tom Murtaugh went down and testified.
You went down to lobby, right?
Right, and testified in the Senate for Senator Alteen's original bill that had all that in it, and that's still where I believe we should have been and would have been the most effective.
And we'll point out that bill eventually got changed so much that even Senator Alteen at one point voted against his own bill.
Right. So, I mean, I guess people are taking the position that this is better than nothing, and it's a start. And I guess we'll see if we can build on it from there. Again, I'm not sure why we have such the reluctance here, as a state, not to address that, in my opinion, in a more straightforward way. I think there's...
Mayor Dennis last week on the program said he thought the bill had some holes in it. It sounds like you agree.
Yes. I mean, I would have much preferred the original version that we went down and testified, and that's the message we want to send from our community.
On another sort of education-related topic, and one that you might have some expertise on as well as a former police officer, there's a bill in the legislature that's kind of interestingly gone back and forth in what it says. It relates to this incident that happened in Monticello a couple of months ago, where they were doing an active shooter training at a school, and the police officers actually walked in with essentially pellet guns and shot some of the teachers to the point where the teachers were injured, had welts and bruises. Originally, the bill said that you could not use projectiles in an active shooter training. And now, just this week, they've amended the bill to say, okay, you can use projectiles if the staff members who will participate agree that that's okay. What is your view as a former law enforcement officer? Do you think that an active shooter training can be done without actually having to shoot people?
Well, I think the bill, and I haven't read the full bill, but just what you've told me, I mean, I think the bill that actually allows it, but there needs to be some type of agreement that people want to do that, is the proper way to go. As a former police officer and SWAT team commander, you know, we used various types of firearms and different items that would allow us to simulate as close as possible the situations that we might find ourselves in. And early on, I did a lot of training for the schools back in the 90s after Columbine happened. The department sent me to some additional training to help train our schools on active shooters and different things like that. And, you know, the ability to use different types of weapons that aren't lethal with different types of projectiles on them has really expanded over the last several years. So there's a lot of options now that are available that weren't available before. And so
let me ask you a little bit of an in the weeds question here, because sure. I'm interested in the answer. It sounds like what happened in Monticello was essentially using pellet guns. And so if you imagine you've got, say, pellet guns and you've got BB guns, you've got modified weapons that could be shooting paintballs, things like that, things that will, you know, not be designed to break the skin. Is there a difference between which of those you might use in your mind?
Oh, yeah, and I don't, again, and I don't know for sure. I don't think in Monticello they used actual pellet guns, because pellet guns and BB guns would be incredibly dangerous
to use.
I mean, that's not a good direction to go. There's a lot of other products out there on the market that's much more suitable for that. But I do think being able to use the projectiles and the right projectiles in a safe way with agreements and with proper instruction at the beginning does add a dimension to the training that's useful. I think it can be useful if done properly and people are in agreement. People have on all the protective gear that they should have on, and there's adequate explanation at the beginning of the scenarios, and people that they're comfortable with it. I think I'm glad that option will be available. And then if there's places that simply are not comfortable with it, I don't think they should be forced to do it either. So I think that's probably a good medium.
Another thing that's been talked a fair amount about in the legislature this year is the possibility that sports betting is going to get expanded in Indiana. Obviously, you live next door to a community that's got a major college that has lots and lots of high-profile sporting events, especially football and basketball games. If that gets expanded, if sports betting again becomes legalized like it once was in this country, does that have any impact on your city, do you think, being so close to Purdue?
Well, that's a good question. That's not something I've thought a lot about, to be honest. You know, and I'm not, that's not something I personally engage in, so I don't have a lot of background knowledge on exactly how that works. But I mean, again, my thoughts on that would be if something like that would happen, and I don't know how the schools feel about that, if betting on that would actually allow betting on college events too.
Well, potentially. I suppose it depends on how each state draws up its rules. And we should say that one of the reasons that it got outlawed in this country was that you had a couple of high profile collegiate point shaving things with college basketball, and that was what led to federal law being there in the first place, saying no, you better not do this anymore. But now that the Supreme Court says sports betting is in fact legal, I mean, you've had states like Delaware where the governor just jumped right in and said, all right, we're going to do this immediately because we see it as a revenue stream. But I think you bring up a good point, which is, should we be interested in whether this is professional sports only or college and the pros? I mean, I think there could be a difference there.
There is for me, and I'm just speaking as Tony Rozworski, the person, the dad, you know, and somebody that was involved in sports and played some college football. I would not like to see betting on high school, college things. Just me personally, I don't think that's a good idea, and I don't know that that's worth the revenue stream, but that's just me personally. I mean, I know a lot of people bet on professional sports, and there's going to be some type of regulations, and, you know, so it was controlled in a way, and there could be some revenue. I mean, I guess I would listen to those discussions, but the thought of, for me personally, betting on, you know, a formal betting on non-professional sports, that's just not something I personally think is probably a good idea.
One or two more topics here in our last couple of minutes. This week's Board of Works meeting talked about the opening of bids for Loeb Stadium. Where are you in that process right now?
Well, there was, as you know, there were 40-some different bids and bids packages. So it's going to take the construction management team and the architects probably about 3 to 5 weeks, because we got to literally go through every company that bid on every possible piece, you know, everything from the seats to the roof to the plumbing to the masonry, and go through each sheet that's in the bid packet of what each line in total. So about 3 to 5 weeks, I think you'll hear us start to make some announcements, maybe not all of the bid packages at the same time, but get through enough of them that we could say, well, we're approving the electrical, we're approving the masonry, we're approving the roof, and but it'll take us, it'll take that team a good 3 to 5 weeks to go through those with a fine-tooth comb.
How much do you want to subcontract something like that? Because obviously you could have very specialized groups of people do all sorts of different facets, because it's going to take a village to build a new baseball stadium. Is there benefit to having a bunch of individual subcontractors who each have a very specific specialty, but then you have to manage 30 or 40 different companies, or trying to consolidate that into trying to find and give bids to a few companies that can each do a couple of different facets of the construction?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, we went the route where we broke the work down into the groups and let groups, we do have a general contractor that will be in charge of the whole project and do some of the general building trades, as it's called. But then we did break the electric down, the masonry down, and we got a lot of bids. So I think from that standpoint, that helped with competition. And I was pleased that several local companies bid, because obviously if we can have local companies work on it that are hiring local people, that keeps the money in the economy here and turning over in our community. Obviously an open bidding process, so you know, people from all over the country also bid, which, you know, that's got its pluses too, right? It helps competition and it helps with some of those costs. But
and it occurs to me that maybe one of the reasons you got a lot of bids was you and I have been talking about this for a couple of years now. People knew this was in the offing. They knew mm-hmm. it was coming, and you've said for a long while, this we think is the timeline. We had to push the timeline back a little bit once or twice, but people had plenty of time to prepare, which would seem to me to be one reason you got so many bids.
Well, that's our hope, that it worked out that way, and that the bids come in as we get through all the numbers the way we want them. But again, like I said, there were several local companies, and since we have been talking about it here locally, like you said, giving them time to plan, and we're hoping that that works out, because again, that the money that we're paying them and the workers that live here, then they're spending the money at the restaurants and the movie theaters and buying what stuff, so it turns over here in the community. But give us a good 3 to 5 weeks. We got to go through them with the fine tooth comb.
Let me ask one more question about the money in our last 30 seconds or so here. This has been advertised as, you know, this is kind of a $20 million project. We've got an approximate amount of money we think we're going to spend. Do you expect to be awarding any bids based on people trying to save you money or trying to include additional perks for the same money? Is any of that in discussion?
Well, that's really, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's not really the way building process works. To try to make it fair to everybody, we have very specific specifications, what can be used, what can't be used, what they're going to do, to try to make that fair. So no, not to answer your question, I think I understand, not at this point, no.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time, and maybe this time next month we'll be talking about who some of those bidders are.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to send questions for our conversation at this same time next week with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. Email those to ask@WBAA.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter, and find all of these archived on the Ask the Mayor page at our website. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.